Ayrım 18.
Sayfa 218. But here the unintelligibility and unacceptability of Christianity are taken seriously. Can you hear the ringing of the bell? Kneel down. They are bringing the sacraments to a dying God. Writing in 1832, Heine connects the intellectual past of Germany with prophecies of a coming catastrophe. The argument is two-sided. On the one hand, there has been a continuous secularization of German life. Catholicism overcomes Nordic hedonism, but at the cost of taking a good deal of it into herself. Luther creates a new German consciousness, partly through the German Bible, but leaves Germany a prey to Protestant spirituality. Spinoza, Wolff, Kant, and Hegel secularize religion, finally, and replace the supernatural by the natural. But all this took place only in the realm of ideas. Heine says sardonically, "It seems to me that a methodical people, such as we are, must begin with the Reformation, must then occupy itself with systems of philosophy, and that only after their completion could it pass to the political revolution." I find this sequence quite rational. The heads that have first served for the speculations of philosophy can afterwards be struck off by the revolution for whatever object it pleases. But philosophy would not have been able to utilize the heads struck off by the revolution that preceded it. Footnote: History of Philosophy and Religion in Germany, translated by J. Snodgrass, page 158. But what in fact has happened is that only the surface of life has been touched by these intellectual changes. Christianity is the only bar to the old paganism of the Germans, and critical philosophy, especially Kantian philosophy, has destroyed it. Christianity, and this is its fairest merit, subdued to a certain extent the brutal warrior ardor of the Germans, but it could not entirely quench it. And when the cross, that remaining talisman, falls to pieces, then will break forth again the ferocity of the old combatants. There will be played in Germany a drama compared to which the French Revolution will seem but an innocent idyll. Footnote: History of Philosophy and Religion in Germany, translated by J. Snodgrass, pages 159-160. The prophecy came true 100 years later. What is its relevance to the history of philosophy? British moral philosophers of the 19th century, as we shall see in the next chapter, essentially found themselves at home in their society. This is not to say that they were passive conformists. Both utilitarians and idealists found themselves among at least the moderate reformers. But the criteria for reform which they proposed were such as they could expect to find echoed by their fellow countrymen. Not so with German philosophers. As with Hegel in his old age, or with his right-wing followers, the German philosophers provided a justification of the status quo, or else they found themselves outside the academic establishment, shunned as critics. Thus, German 19th century moral philosophers cannot hope to represent themselves as merely analyzing what is already present in ordering moral consciousness. They see the moral as something they are bound to condemn. Equally, from the other side, ordinary morality finds its sources in romantic rationalism or in the ideals of Prussian bureaucracy, and requires a hostility to the purely critical intellect. Hence, the great moral philosophers of the 19th century are all anti-German Germans, constructing systems against the moral status quo. Heine is their forerunner, but the great names among them are Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. Schopenhauer stands in sharp contrast to both Hegel and Kierkegaard. Against Hegel's view of every part of the universe having meaning in so far as it stands in relation to a systematic rational whole, and Kierkegaard's stress on the value of the individual, Schopenhauer sees the universe as meaningless and the individual as having no value. He admired Plato and Kant because they did not attempt to find the rational order in the merely phenomenal. He hated and despised Hegel, whom he thought of as a time server. And professional academic philosophers in general, he thought committed to supplying metaphysical consolation in return for payment. By the Greeks they were called sophists, by the moderns they are called professors of philosophy. But his dislike of Hegel has to be set beside the fact that he attempted to rival Hegel as a lecturer in Berlin by putting on his lectures at the same hour as Hegel's. Hegel's lectures remained crowded, Schopenhauer's were empty. What is Schopenhauer's message? The world is the expression of blind striving or will. We know our own inner nature as will in direct experience. Thought is but one of the outward forms or disguises taken by will. Life is blind, cruel, meaningless. But we disguise this fact in our theorizing, and in our actions we cling to life through extremes of pain and suffering. The natural world bears witness to the continuous reproduction of the species and the continuous destruction of the individual. The forms remain the same. The individuals who exemplify them continually perish. In this we get a hint of Schopenhauer's relation to Plato and Kant. Thus, experience testifies to the way in which the world is pervaded by pain and destruction, while religion and philosophy try to construct justifications for the universe, which will show that pain and destruction have not the last word, and in so doing they themselves testify to the force of cosmic will, which has as its aim the continuing of existence on any terms. Schopenhauer explains religion as the human expression of this desire for continued existence. Were we totally certain of our survival after death, or of our extinction at death, religion would be functionless. Moreover, it is not only in our anxiety to continue existing that we exhibit ourselves as manifestations of will. We also do so in the way that we devote ourselves to continuing the species. Sexual passion overrides all our impulses to avoid suffering and responsibility. Yet the pleasures of passionate love are momentary and vanishing compared with the troubles it brings upon us. We may rationalize our pursuit of various ends and claim to find good in achieving them. The truth is, we are what we are constituted by the blind strivings of will, and our thinking cannot alter anything about us. So seriously does Schopenhauer take this that he treats our entire personality as given from the outset. What we are essentially is will, and unalterable will. No experience, no reflection, no learning can alter what we are. Our character is fixed, our motives are determined. It follows that traditional morality and traditional moral philosophy are founded on a mistake, the mistake of supposing that moral precepts can alter conduct, whether our own or that of others. What then can moral philosophy do? It can explain the moral valuations which we do, in fact, make by an analysis of human nature. If we carry through such an analysis, we discover three basic motives in human nature. The first is our old friend, self-interest. On this, Schopenhauer has little original to say. The second, however, is the fruit of acute observation. It is malice. Schopenhauer observed, as perhaps no previous philosopher or psychologist had done, the gratuitous character of malice. We do not harm others only when and in order that we may benefit ourselves. And when others undergo misfortunes, our pleasure in their misfortunes is unconnected with any thought of our own self-interest. It is pure pleasure. For man is the only animal which causes pain to others without any further purpose than just to cause it. Other animals never do it except to satisfy their hunger or in the rage of combat. The appalling record of human life, of the suffering and infliction of pain, is relieved only when the third motive, sympathy or compassion, appears. To feel compassion is to put oneself imaginatively in the place of the sufferer and to alter one's actions appropriately, either by desisting from what would have caused pain or by devoting oneself to its relief. But the exhibiting of compassion has yet a further significance. In a moment of compassion, we extinguish self-will. We cease to strive for our own existence. We are relieved from the burden of individuality, and we cease to be plaything of will. The same relief is granted to us in the contemplation of works of art. And in the life of a Christ or of a Buddha, we find a systematic disciplining of self and exercising of compassion, in which selfhood and striving approach the goal of final extinction. Thus, Schopenhauer's message is, in the end, an injunction to return to the sources of Buddhist teaching. A first reaction to Schopenhauer must always be, perhaps, to note the contrast between the brilliance of his observations of human nature, which go far beyond anything I have suggested, and the arbitrary system building in which those observations are embedded. He stands out among philosophers by his insistence upon all pervasive character of pain and suffering in human life to date. But his general pessimism is as unilluminating as it is striking. Because for him these evils arise from existence as such, he is unable to give any accurate account of them in their historical context. All epochs and states of affairs, all societies and all projects are equally infected by evil. But he provides an important corrective to the easy liberal optimism of so much of 19th century life, and those who reacted against that optimism find Schopenhauer a seminal influence. Certainly, he was this upon Nietzsche. Nietzsche, in fact, stands at the point at which all the contradictory influences of the 19th century are brought to bear. He was himself only too conscious of this and sought isolation. Part of what he admired in Schopenhauer was his ability to cast off academic and conformist ambitions. His loneliness as a character is matched by his resistance to the spirit of the age. He intensely disliked the crude imperialist politics of the German Empire of 1871. He hated pan-Germanism in all forms and especially in its racialist, anti-Semitic ones. But he equally disliked modern socialism, which he saw as a new incarnation of the Christian values he most despised. Christianity is for Nietzsche at the core of the modern sickness. Why? Because Christianity has led to a systematic devaluation of this world in favor of the next, and thus to a false spirituality. Above all, because Christianity has embodied values that were destructive of all moral values, including its own. Nietzsche sees himself as writing in an age of moral vacuum. He has three tasks: to exhibit the historical and psychological causes of the vacuum, to unmask false candidates for the role of the new morality, and finally, to transcend the limitations of all hitherto existing systems of morality, and by a transvaluation of values, to prophetically introduce a new way of life. The historical background to the present malaise is rooted in Christianity's victory over the Greeks. Nietzsche, in The Genealogy of Morals, begins by attacking English psychologists who have argued that the word good was first applied to altruistic actions because these were socially useful. Nietzsche seems to be referring to the whole utilitarian tradition and to Herbert Spencer. "People tell me," he writes, "that those men are simply dull old frogs." In fact, he replies, the egoistic-altruistic contrast is not primitive, for in the earliest uses of good, it does not arise. Good was the word used by the noble, mighty, highly placed, and high-minded. Its earliest uses were in contradistinction to all that was base, low-minded, and plebeian. As we saw in discussing the history of Agathos in Greek, Nietzsche is fundamentally in the right. He is right too when he relates how the word good is in due time used in conjunction with altered criteria. But in place of the actual complexities of Greek and Hebrew history, he puts a sharp contrast between the original Greek aristocrat and the Jew. The Jew substitutes for the aristocratic morality of self-affirmation the slave morality of envy. The Christian finally exalts the virtues of the weak, the humble, the poor, the oppressed. Not in fact because the love of these, but because of a hidden rancor and hate of strength, of pride in life, of self-affirmation. About Jesus, Nietzsche seems to have been ambivalent. On Paul or Luther, he feels free to unleash his rage. Faith was at all times, for example in Luther, only a cloak, a pretext, a screen behind which the instincts played their game, a shrewd blindness about the dominance of certain instincts. Footnote: The Antichrist, 39. Yet now God is dead. The sanction of traditional slave morality has gone, and all the contemporary attempts to replace Christianity are forms of self-deception in one way or another. Kantian ethics pretends to give the endorsement of universal law to the individualist's moral attitudes. Kant wanted to prove in a way that would dumbfound the common man that the common man was right. But Nietzsche's accusation is that, in fact, Kant assumes what he sets out to prove. He takes it for granted that we are entitled to make moral judgments and inquires what must be the case if that is so. He never asks, as Nietzsche does, whether we are so entitled. Nietzsche's reply is that we, in trying to bind others by universal moral judgments, pretend to be speaking in the name of pure practical reason, but are in fact using these judgments as a weapon against those of whom we are jealous. The utilitarians are also attacked on grounds drawn from psychology. Man does not seek happiness. Only the Englishman does that. Footnote: The Twilight of the Idols. 1, 2. Not happiness, but power is the fundamental human goal. Sympathetic interpreters of the Nietzschean will to power have insisted that power, Nietzsche, does not mean power over others. He saw the ideal expression of power in the type of personality in which the limitations of self-love have been overcome, but which nonetheless affirms itself. It is when the will to power is not allowed expression, but is hidden and repressed, that it turns into a drive against others, summoning up ideals in the name of which such oppression can be carried out. But Nietzsche's examples of the type of personality of which he thought well are highly dubious. In what he is condemning, he is far more clearly justified. The emasculated asceticism of Wagner's romantic Christian Parsifal he abhors. Even Cesare Borgia is far healthier than that. Health and sickness are key words in Nietzsche. Napoleon is the synthesis of the human and the brutish. Julius Caesar and Spinoza are greatly admired. And in a most vivid and telling phrase, Nietzsche speaks of his ideal as the Roman Caesar with Christ's soul. Yet from all this, does one get a clear picture of the Superman, a bad but by now unavoidable translation of Übermensch, the man who transcends? The conventional charge against Nietzsche has been that he was the forerunner of Nazism. The prophet of the blonde beast of later anti-Semitic glorification. The conventional answer has fallen into two parts. The first, which is unassailable, is that while he was the critic of Judaism as religion and as morality, he was equally the critic of Christianity, and that racialism, most of all German racialism, he thought Slavs on the whole superior to Germans and preferred Poles most of all, was condemned by him in the frankest terms. The second is that the Superman is a morally unambiguous and praiseworthy character. But the difficulty here is to know just what content the notion of the Superman had for Nietzsche. The multiplication of reservations renders everything more obscure. What worries us in Nietzsche is perhaps like what worries us in Kant. We have already noticed Hegel's criticism of Kant that the conscientious moral agent dominated by the form of the categorical imperative is in fact licensed to do anything at all, provided he does it conscientiously. What looked like a restrictive guide to conduct is in fact empty of restriction. So likewise, and more crudely, with the notion of the Superman. In the name of the will to power, what might one not do? In what does the superiority of the superior type of human being manifest itself in late 19th century terms? Nietzsche was flagrantly misrepresented by his nationalist, anti-Semitic, and finally Nazi sister. But what one must insist upon is that both the violence of Nietzsche's language and the emptiness of the Nietzschean ideal provided an excellent scaffolding for Frau Förster Nietzsche to build around. There is a deep historical irresponsibility in Nietzsche. The explanation of it is, in part, that he believed the mass of man to be beyond redemption anyway. Not to the people let Zarathustra speak. To lure many away from the herd, therefore I came. We thus end the 19th century with the most perceptive of German moralists turning his back upon his own society. It would not be absurd to try to understand this attitude in the light of a society which was about to turn its back upon the whole human tradition of morality. Thomas Mann once spoke of the artist as a seismograph in whose work tremors as yet unobserved are registered. The German philosophers of the 19th century signal tremors far beneath the surface of their society. They signal catastrophe to come. Chapter 17. Reformers, Utilitarians, Idealists. A striking feature of moral and political argument in the modern world is the extent to which it is innovators, radicals, and revolutionaries who revive old doctrines, while their conservative and reactionary opponents are the inventors of new ones. So the contract theorists and the believers in natural rights in the 17th century were reviving features of medieval doctrines, while the doctrine of the divine right of kings was essentially a 16th and 17th century invention. So also, at the time of the French Revolution, it is Tom Paine who revives Locke, and it is Burke who invents a quite new form of the appeal to tradition. Paine is not a source of philosophical argument in himself. His importance lies in the way in which he, and more especially his French associates, helped to force the moral traditions of the English ruling oligarchy away from the doctrine of natural rights. How did they do this? The danger of all appeals to general principles on one's own behalf on a particular occasion is that one renders oneself liable to have the same principles invoked against one on some subsequent occasion. Precisely, this is what happened to the English ruling class. The principles of 1688 were invoked against them by the Americans in 1776 and by the revolutionaries against their French colleagues in 1789. It was this fact which underpinned Tom Paine's appeal to the rights of man, and it was this fact that Richard Price, whom we have already noticed in his role as a believer in the rational intuition of moral first principles, emphasized in his sermon at the dissenting meeting house in Old Jewry in November 1789. Price emphasized the assertion in 1689 of the right to choose and to dismiss sovereigns, and above all of the right to frame anew the Constitution, and reiterated the correctness of this assertion. In so doing, he played his part in goading both to fury and to reply Edmund Burke. Burke's attitude to the mass of man is well conveyed by his phrase, a swinish multitude. His attitude to the rights of man is entirely coherent with this. He denies, first as a matter of history, that the Whig Revolution of 1688 did involve the kind of assertion of rights that Price claimed. The displacement of James II was due to a fear lest his critics should weaken the throne and the hereditary principle. Hence the preference for the next line in succession, even though it was the German line of Hanover, in order that the principle might not be discredited. But Burke was not merely concerned with history. Not only was 1689 not an appeal to natural rights, there are no such rights. They are metaphysical fictions. Burke says of the writers of French Revolution that they are so taken up with their theories about the rights of man that they have totally forgotten his nature. By nature, Burke does not mean a state prior to a social contract, but society as it is, and above all, as it has grown to be. Theoretically based plans for the reform of society are violations of a divinely ordained history of social growth, so that Burke can speak of social development as the known march of the ordinary providence of God. Established institutions are thus rated as high by Burke as they are low by Rousseau. Both invoke nature, but while for Rousseau nature is contrasted with society, for Burke nature includes society. Burke, however, does not view nature simply as all that is, for if nature were all-inclusive, one could not war against it as revolutionaries do. Nature is in fact equated by Burke with certain established norms and procedures, including the procedure of relying on prevailing habit rather than on argument. Politics ought to be adjusted not to human reasonings, but to human nature, of which the reason is but a part, and by no means the greatest part. Footnote: we are afraid to put man to live and trade each on his own stock of reason, because we suspect that this stock in each man is small, and that the individuals would do better to avail themselves of the general bank and capital of natures and of ages. Reflections on the Revolution in France, Everyman edition, page 84. This is not just a doctrine about politics, but about the moral life in general. Hence Burke's defense of what he calls prejudice. Prejudice is of ready application in the emergency. It previously engages the mind in a steady course of wisdom and virtue, and does not leave the man hesitating in the moment of decision, skeptical, puzzled, and unresolved. Prejudice renders a man's virtue his habit, and not a series of unconnected acts. Footnote: Locke, Sit. Burke's positions are of importance, if only because of their subsequent influence. The assessments of them confronts one initial difficulty, namely that if Burke is right, rational argument upon these topics is misplaced. Hence, by even venturing to argue with him, we appear to presuppose the truth of what we are trying to establish. But this difficulty is not in fact ours, but Burke's. For to deny the possibility of rational argument playing the role of arbiter means that, in advancing one's views, one cannot be appealing to any criterion by which they may be established. But if this is so, then not only can one not argue in one's own favor, but one has made it difficult to understand what it could mean to call one's views true or false. For the application of these predicates always involves an appeal to some criterion. Suppose, however, that at this point we look to Burke's practice of arguing rather than to his principle of condemning argument. We shall then find in his arguments two mistakes, both diagnosed by William Godwin, the anarchist, in what is in effect a reply to Burke's reflections on the revolution in France, political justice. First of all, Burke confuses society and the state. He assimilates particular forms of political institution to institutions in general, from premises which assert merely the need for stable and established social arrangements, he tries to derive the conclusion that Louis XVI's head should not be cut off. The roots of this confusion are more interesting than the confusion itself. Burke understands that appeal to moral and other norms presupposes an established form of social life. He tries to picture the revolutionary theorist as a man who wishes to destroy the very social life which is necessary to give meaning to the norms in the name of which he intends to carry out his act of destruction. But in so doing, he equates the notion of an established form of social life with the notion of an established set of institutional arrangements. In fact, the institutions of a society may well be at odds with its norms. To maintain these institutions may be fatally destructive. Burke never noticed the fact that revolutions are extremely difficult to make. Theorists become revolutionaries only when their theories are able to articulate a deep dissatisfaction which the theorists did not invent. And at this point, it is the refusal to destroy and recreate social institutions which is destructive of social life itself. The true nihilists in history were all kings. Charles I, Louis XVI, and Tsar Nicholas. The revolutionaries in their societies had to save social life from their rulers' destructive maintenance of the existing order. Secondly, Burke's defense of prejudice and habit against reflective criticism rests on an inadequate analysis of the notion of following a rule. I may in my conduct follow and abide by rules which I have never made explicit. Breaches of such rules may shame or shock me without my articulating any formula adequately expressive of the rule. But such unreflective behavior is as much rule-governed as is the behavior of the man who consciously invokes an expressly formulated maxim. And it is clearly the kind of behavior which Burke wants to exalt. We use words like habit and prejudice to bring out not that such conduct is not governed by rules, but that our attitude to the rules is unreflective. Burke is right to suppose that the moral life would be destroyed by our reflecting upon our rules of conduct prior to each and every action. Action must for the most part rely on our habitual dispositions to do this rather than that. But if for this reason reflection can only be occasional, the importance of such occasions is heightened, not lessened. Because we are right not to be continually re-scrutinizing our principles, it does not follow that we are wrong ever to scrutinize them. So Godwin speaks rightly of a need to articulate and examine them, to cast away the coat of prejudice, and to leave nothing but the naked reason. Godwin, who was married to the mother of female emancipation, Mary Wollstonecraft, and who was the father of Shelley's second wife, was the prototype of the innovating moralist in the modern world. The kind of abuse which was later to be hurled at a Bertrand Russell or a Wilhelm Reich was showered on Godwin. De Quincey recalled in his reminiscences that most people felt of Mr. Godwin with the same alienation and horror as of a Gaul or a bloodless vampire or the monster created by Frankenstein. Godwin, in fact, was a humane and sensitive man who applied himself to the classical problem of 18th century moral theory. He accepted from Hume the view that we are moved to action by feelings, not by reason, and from Locke the view that it is reason which discerns moral distinctions. He thus has a more complex position than most 18th century writers. Our feelings move us to action, but they will only move us to right action if we have a clear and rational view of the facts. Such a view includes taking into account the consequences of our actions. It must also include the application to them of principles such as that of impartiality, of not making exceptions to general rules in our own or in anyone else's favor. Godwin's view that there are rational moral principles of an inescapable kind is never developed with sufficient clarity. But he is as much as anyone since Aristotle, the father of the notion that at the foundation of morals lies the principle that if morality is to be argued about at all, then the onus of justification lies upon those who propose to treat men differently. The very process of moral argument presupposes the principle that everyone is to be treated the same until reason to the contrary is shown. This principle is formal in the sense that it does not prescribe how, in fact, anyone is to be treated. But it has important practical consequences, for it forces into the open the justification of treating people differently because of their age, sex, intelligence, or color. Equality, in its most minimal form, is embodied in a society in which this is the case. Godwin himself extended the scope of principles of reason far beyond this. He taught that reason showed me that there is more value in the happiness of a number of men than in that of one, and that this is true irrespective of whether that one is myself, my friend or relative, or a total stranger. Hence I taught to prefer the general happiness to my own. To the rejoinder that if I do so, it is only because I am so psychologically constituted that I will feel unhappier if I disregard the general happiness of others than if I disregard my own. Godwin's reply is that the pain which I feel at disregarding the unhappiness of others is felt only because I recognize that I ought to be benevolent. The pain cannot be the reason for my action, for it is only because I have quite a different sort of reason for it than I am liable to feel the characteristic pain. It is only in the light of my rational principles, for example, that my own actions will inspire in me satisfaction or guilt. If men have within themselves rational principles prescribing the general good, why do men disregard that good? Godwin's answer is that we are corrupted by the social environment and above all by the influence of government. For government claims an authority which belongs only to right reason, and right reason is only grasped by individuals, assisted by the rational persuasion of other individuals. The hope for man lies in the perfectibility of human nature. Godwin's belief is that the influences of social and governmental forms can be overcome and replaced by a free community of rational beings in which it is the opinions of those who are informed an objective that will carry weight. Godwin is a figure curiously akin to and curiously at odds with Bentham. Where Godwin is utopian in his political proposals, Bentham is the careful reformer, anxious to escape accusations of utopianism by being prepared to suggest the exact size of the beds to be used in prisons or the precise reforms needed in the laws of evidence. Where Godwin believes human nature to be committed often to disinterestedness, Bentham believes that private interest always needs to be weighted and guided if it is to serve public interest. Yet Bentham's criterion of the greatest happiness of the greatest number is essentially the same as Godwin's. Both were in limited sympathy with the French Revolution, both represent the future rather than the past. It can be put like this. If one takes the stock of characteristically modern liberal clichés and banalities, one is in a world of which both Godwin and Bentham are ancestors. For both, society is nothing but a collection of individuals. For both, the good of individuals is a matter of their happiness. For both, that happiness can be summed and calculated. In Godwin, the notions of good and evil still retain some of their traditional force. In Bentham, they are to be redefined in terms of pleasure and pain. Bentham's thesis was not, of course, that words such as good and right were or had been used by most people to mean productive of the greatest happiness of the greatest number, or some equivalent praise. It is not even the case that Bentham always propounded the same thesis. Sometimes he seems to be concerned not with the meaning of terms in the moral vocabulary, but only with the statement of a moral and political criterion. Sometimes he does indeed offer us a definition, but in the form of a proposal rather than of an elucidation. He says, in effect, that we may define good and right in terms of the concept of the greatest happiness, of the greatest number, or we may not, but that, unless we do, shall talk nonsense. And sometimes he seems not to distinguish these tasks, nor for his purposes does he need to distinguish them.